Markiplier, one of the world's most prominent gaming YouTubers, made a movie this year.
Technically still making a video, just one very big, intense video.
And many of you said, hey, that was good. Whoa, I thought, Markiplier movie good? Can this really be true? The answer, as I would eventually discover, was, no girl, it's not good.
Funny how some things survive and others don't.
The simple why of it is a broad lack of skill. The thing feels super amateur in almost every aspect. The structure is noodly. The way it's shot is basic. And the whole film rests on watching dear sweet Mark trapped in a dark room on his own, expressing some emotions to mostly just himself.
It doesn't matter. Does it? It doesn't matter.
In a stroke of, I would say, inspired genius, Markiplier decided to have his directorial moment here in the form of an adaptation of a short, effective, spooky video game. I like this idea. I think it's pretty fun to take your main thing, playing and reacting to scary games, and twist that into a movie. I just wish the film had taken a more self-aware approach to that instead of trying to play it completely straight as a bog-standard horror movie. But whatever, I wouldn't be saying that if the movie had impressed me, so I suppose it's a moot point. I just like the idea of playing with that, with incorporating some aspect of Let's Play as a medium. You know, what if he just kept being like... It's crazy that Markiplier wrote, directed, starred in, edited, and produced this movie. You know, he was the executive producer, he's managing the distribution himself, he's doing it all. That's true madness. It certainly is impressive, but nevertheless, I did not like the movie. So maybe some delegation would have helped, but on the other hand, maybe Markiplier was the best person for all of these jobs. I don't know. He certainly did them. Good for him. Now, what exactly is Iron Lung? Iron Lung is a game about piloting a tiny, rusty submarine in a desolate future world on a distant moon. It's a short game with very simple gameplay. You must maneuver your vessel to a sequence of points on a map, uncovering murky mysteries of the sea as you go along.
What is that? That don't look like nothing.
Which is made of blood, by the way, and it's human blood.
How fucking cool does a blood ocean sound?
Details of the in-universe lore are teased out slowly while you play, and since you can't see your environment at all from inside the sub, the photos you take intermittently with your clunky onboard camera become tantalizing clues.
Oh, it's a skeleton? It's a skeleton!
It's hard to make out what's out there, but you start seeing things that look like skeletons. You think to yourself, is that a huge, horrible fish? And eventually you find an unnatural, unmoving beam of bright light emitting from a single spot in the sea. What the hell?
Well, that's... a thing.
Through these beautifully paced murky details, the player is dipped into and ripped out of a growing, politically charged fear of the seemingly purposefully obfuscated unknown, and slowly lowered into a dark and tantalizing cosmic horror.
Can we look at what's making the blip? I guess we could try that.
Much of the game's effectiveness is in the beaten-up details of the submarine itself, reflective of the decayed society it belongs to. You are an unnamed convict forced to carry out a mission that will likely kill you, and the mystical disappearance of all habitable celestial bodies and the people who live on them and colonize space seems itself like a great biblical judgment on humanity, a damning response to the industrialization of space. The only survivors, we're told, are space station dwellers, those situated on man-made off-planet structures. And so the universe has developed a weird post-catastrophe social system of factional control and prisoners put to work. It's an immediately engaging, richly detailed world for a game that feels so sparse and austere. And you feel it in every detail. The creaking and clunking of your sub, the steady accumulation of blood through some inadequate seal, the bitter letter left by the prisoner who operated it before you.
When they put you in here, they don't want you to return.
Many of these things are made more impactful and believable by the simple fact that you are controlling your player character rather than watching a guy scrunch and squint in a movie. And the atmosphere is really delicately crafted and scripted for that very direct, personal mode of experience and exploration. I liked it.
Let's go, let's go, let's go. Let's go, let's go, let's go.
Mark played the game on his YouTube channel in 2022, the year of its release, and clearly loved it.
That was actually excellent. That was incredible. I really loved that experience. It's so nice. novel. It's so interesting.
He singled out the constant and pervasive sense of fear that defined the experience.
There's not like a super direct thing that's threatening you. It's everything around you is threatening you. And it's constant and pervasive.
And he made this face. He's just like me. An angel came down from heaven, presumably, and whispered in his ear,
Marky Moo, it's time to make your Iron Lung movie.
And so he got to work, with the game's creator Dave Szymanski on hand to assist with the screenplay and stare at him like this for 12 hours a day on set. Hey, can we make the submarine more nasty? The submarine looks a little too clean to me. Can we make it look like it stinks? Like, it really stinks. So here comes the movie. Immediately, something felt wrong to me. The film has this really stark look that reminds me less of grainy, grubby amateur filmmaking and more of low-budget TV. Whoa. There's a base level of competence and cash, but the lighting and shot composition feels stale and basic. Dimly lit movies often look their best when they frame their details in bold, specific, maybe even colorful light. When they make use of small light sources like torches, now blinding in the darkness, or blinking tiny equipment lights used to emphasize the nervousness of confinement, or to cast an unnatural, gloomy glow on a frightened character's face. In Iron Lung, while the control panel lights look nice, there is a touch of IKEA showroom about the whole thing. Additionally, Markiplier almost doesn't feel like he's playing a character, but he's not quite himself either.
What?
It's more like he's occupying the mind of simply the general concept of a man.
People that I thought were my brothers abandoned me!
I thought I'd die.
Yep. That sure is a guy. After wriggling around a bit in his sub and getting the first of what will be many stray blood drops splashed onto him, he ends up being brought to the surface. The dripping blood is perhaps a small detail, but it strikes me as emblematic of the sort of cheesy approach this film takes. In the game, the blood steadily rises as you play through tasks, an element of the ambient increase in apparent danger that happens just out of sight of the player as the game progresses. It's a key part of the way the game makes you feel out of control. Things just happen to you, and then you're knee-deep in a blood leak and hearing louder and more horrible metallic clanks and sinister moans. But in the movie, Mark's just getting a little splatter of blood now and then. It reminds you of the leaky, creaky nature of the sub, but it's much goofier. The movie will add its own ideas, scenes, and details to attempt to build that momentum, especially with the crescendo of muffled plot dump that comes toward the end, but it can't quite figure out how to maintain an ongoing, oppressive atmosphere. Splat Markiplier with a little more blood, boys. We've got 80,000 gallons of it.
Was it a world record for the amount of blood used in a film?
Yeah.
Since Mark's character, Simon, is all by himself for most of the movie, we have to endure a lot of talking to yourself dialogue.
I'm fucked.
Much of this is him floundering between unconvincing emotional states.
Don't mind me. I'm just trying to go home. Yes!
Maybe this would interest me if I felt that I knew anything, really, about the character at this point, but most powerfully, his central personality trait is that he just says fuck a lot.
Why is this fucking hot down there?
Fuck that and fuck you!
He's crazy, he just keeps saying fuck and fuck.
No fucking way! What does it matter if you find a big fucking skeleton? Shut the fuck up!
Every single one of these is overperformed and spat out. It makes the performance feel really fake. If just a few of these were exasperated, defeated F-word drops like fuck or oh fuck it, or maybe damn fuck, I could imagine it endearing us to the character, painting a picture of him and how he responds to the cycle of emotions he's experiencing across the movie with all kinds of different fucks. But as it is, it's so illustrative of the movie's failure to make him feel like a real person. Instead of all manner of evocative fucks, he gives us a comical number of them thrown out like hard farts and scrunches up his body and face in a stilted imitation of relatable anguish. This guy might be having his very first human feeling.
What is this? I was scared.
I was naive and thought, oh, One Room will be an easier movie. Much harder. So way harder.
When Simon surfaced to chat with his captors for a second early in the movie, I was excited. I knew the game was exclusively a One Room situation, and I was fascinated by the choice to do something different, to bring that submarine right out of the ocean. I was also pumped up to see him talk to another character in person.
Hey!
I do think this sequence is one of the better ones in the movie, but while Caroline Kaplan's performance is serviceable as Ava, the blonde woman in control...
This is bigger than any of us, so just do your job.
Something about these interactions has a weird, uncanny AAA video game cutscene feel.
You'll have to hit it hard too.
Anyway, Simon learns he has to get dunked right back in the drink, and down he goes to properly start his little death mission. We enjoy a montage of him doing the checkpoint tasks of the game, and then we move into the central plot. He finds the lost ship encased in a weird beam of light, and a mysterious woman begins communicating with him.
You have no idea what's waiting for us down here.
Who is that woman? We also have some goofy stuff with Simon taping the camera button down so he can use the resulting screen light to illuminate the rest of his sub in order to crawl into a hall and retrieve a black box recorder. And while I did think indignantly, that wouldn't work, that tape wouldn't hold, I have to admit that this is a kind of fun way of using the design of the submarine and its equipment creatively for a beat. I'll give him that. I think I'd have enjoyed a little bit more of a lean into a goofy boy persona, give Mark a little more to work with, you know, make him a bit of a scamp.
This is gonna sound made up.
The skeleton is gone!
Also, the tape, in fact, doesn't halt. I don't think he would have been able to tape it down for a single second, though. I just don't think tape could have controlled a strong, beautiful button like that. But this is really the point at which it goes off the rails with its misguided dive into a crazy lore world. One of the most delicious things about the game is the way it reveals information to you. Quite a lot of the info you can find on your background and the society you're living in can be found through a computer terminal in the back of your submarine, although this was not originally present but added in an update a few months after initial release. You figure out that you can just type a bunch of keywords in there and read tantalizing little paragraphs about the world.
Iron lung.
Oh, for example, the Consolidation of Iron, or COI, is a brotherhood of 3 space stations and 2 spacecraft, found on the principle of collectivism and ruled by popular vote of all citizens numbering 257 at the time of this entry. Its name comes from the iron and steel materials its 2 main stations are constructed from, and the principle of unity and togetherness in the face of menace from other surrounding stations such as Eden. While grammatically awkward at times, these present a strong, clear vision of the fraught political world that has sprung up around an apocalyptic event that is not well understood. But the movie faces the problem of teasing these ideas out into a feature-length narrative, and as a result, really overshoots. We see a few sourceless flashbacks that try to translate some of the Eden versus COI faction stuff to the screen, and it just doesn't work at all.
Stop saying they're gone. We can all see
My son. Those stars are already dead.
It doesn't hit the emotional beats it's going for, and it also just looks bad. I don't want to see this child. Something about it really reminds me of Final Fantasy XIII's cutscenes.
So, soldier. What's your angle?
There's just an inescapable soullessness and nothingness about it. I'm saying that as a Final Fantasy XIII respecter, by the way, but I would kill Vanil with my own hands. Just saying my truth.
My wife, she's a pulseless sea.
No.
The movie essentially diverges from the game when Simon discovers the lost submarine, the cracked SM-8, and its beam of unnatural light. Where in the game this is a notable, exciting picture at a pivotal checkpoint that you continue on from, heading deeper into the sea, in the movie it's a turning point. Simon sees this and starts hearing a voice.
Is this another trick? Who is this?
Hello everybody, my name is Markiplier.
Oh God! Please get us out.
He's also able to report it to the team at the surface so he can have some back and forth with them, and so he's sent on his final mission to connect to the destroyed sub and gather its data. Because we desperately need other characters to be present in order to structure a climax for the movie, we now really veer away from the game's lore and logic. Simon has to listen to Ava's plea that he retrieve and transport the information to her to save humanity.
If we could pull this off, there's hope for the COI, for Eden, for everyone.
Not knowing if he can trust her promise to bring him out of the sea if he does, and he also has to listen to the mystery woman from the SM-8 as she begs him to do the opposite, to destroy the data.
Destroy the data.
Do you have it?
The SM-8 is lost.
This rapidly devolves into a fever dream of convoluted madness.
There is nothing else for us now.
You're just a piece of shit that doesn't even know it's dead. What do you know?
Where the game showed us murky images depicting unclear forms that you could kinda sorta make out, the movie shows us a scary fish straight up. We start wading through scenes full of blood as it pours in and the voice is screaming and begging, and Simon has to scramble for the black box to try and nobly save his computer files, and he ties it to a life vest so it can float to the surface and maybe someone can grab it and save the world. Meanwhile, he gets got by this monster thingy, but the weird random growing bloody flesh glob tendrils that are now erupting everywhere, because I guess that's what this monster is all about, collide with Simon's little tree necklace that he found on the floor of the submarine earlier on, because another prisoner left it behind, and of course they're both from Eden, the place to find mostly by having a tree that Simon remembers from his childhood, and there's some crazy biological chemical reaction that turns that seed instantly into a big tree, and the submarine explodes, and the monster dies, and basically it all happens. You know, it's all happening. It's crazy in there, in the blood sea. I can't really see it, and I can barely follow it, but that is basically what goes on, and it is unwatchable gibberish. The uncomfortable, still atmosphere of the game has been replaced by a loud, wet mess. I appreciate the allure of an explosive end, and that any venture into cosmic horror is inevitably ambitious, but the movie is so marred by its pursuit of a big action sequence, which makes it all the stranger that people defend it by positioning it as a slow, thoughtful movie that requires patience and a taste for unflashy filmmaking. Some responses to a Reddit thread where someone asked why reviews had been mixed were, I've noticed people in general don't like slow burn / psychological horror as much as I wish they did. And I'm not really surprised. This kind of movie isn't for everyone, and mainstream movies usually are quite flashy action and will spoon feed information, so people may be more used to that. What are you talking about, boys? This was the epitome of a loud, flashy climax that tries to shovel as much lore into you as it can. Just because a movie is so boring that it feels 7 hours long, that doesn't make it a slow burn. To be a slow burn, surely one must have something to burn. We're really not given anything to chew on. The movie's central conflict is not even concerned with Simon excavating the mystery or worming his way out of forced labor or confronting the mysterious presence in the ocean. It's about him accepting that he must die.
But I want to live.
This makes sense. The game starts out as an expedition and steadily reveals that you are progressing on the inevitable path to your own death, and the emotional crux is that regardless of the fact that you have been sent down here to die by a governing body that considers you expendable, your mission's value to humanity may very well be worth your life. This could have been a great opportunity for the movie to explore philosophical questions about self-sacrifice, government-mandated heroism, and the broader meaning of personal liberty in grungy post-apocalyptic space, but beyond Markiplier straightforwardly crying, pleading, throwing up, and farting about how he wants to live, it doesn't explore the emotionally devastating reality of this predicament. He doesn't progress, really, through the shock of it. He just says, I want to live. Is that so bad?
I just want to live. Is that so wrong?
That's not a statement I have to ponder, and there's nothing more to it. There's no exploration of the life he's been removed from, there's no exploration of the activism that put him in this place to begin with, unless you count those flashbacks, which, not really. There's no exploration of him as a person with thoughts and interests and traits. There's nothing to burn. There's nothing being burned. Damn, why do you want to live so bad, bro? What are you living for? When they put you in here, they don't want you to return. And even if they do, and even if they keep their promises, what freedom waits for you? A few dying ships and a sea of dead stars? Some of the moments where we piece together what's going on with this strange woman's voice entering the submarine as if by magic do at least communicate this almost biblically strange feeling.
They're calling to us. This is our salvation.
But the movie is, if anything, too quick to make it obvious that she is a monsterized adoption of the voice of a ghost. Doesn't let us sit in the ambiguity and confusion for long enough to build its atmosphere. By the end, we've gone too fast. We've barreled forwards. We've made a sludge. The world feels small and false for all its attempts to be big and scary, and no amount of blood is enough to fill it. I'm struck by the comparative simplicity of the game's ending. There, you head to the final checkpoint, position yourself just right for that last photo you've been tasked with collecting, and you rush to the back of the submarine to press that now familiar shutter button. Only before you can reach it, bam, a big fish gets you.
295 confirmed beautifully.
It's the uncomplicated nature of this, in contrast with that unexplained freak beam of cosmic light from earlier, that really makes it a satisfying ending. Here, that light beam and everything that could illuminate what the mysterious quiet rapture actually is, it's background to the simple primal danger of the animal world, the environment, the very thing affected by the colonization of space and the warring factions of left behind humans. Perhaps the quiet rapture is a punishment for the rot humans had brought forth into the universe. Perhaps it's a godly being of some kind here for cruel retribution. Or perhaps it is itself a cosmic symbol of the untamable, unconquerable nature of, well, nature itself. A universe of life too powerful for people to end. And so you can be destroyed by the godly beam, the photons that build the universe, or you can be destroyed by a big hungry viperfish ready for its dinner. And maybe, either way, it's the same. You are the universe's yummy, yummy snack. So, Iron Lung, the movie, doesn't satisfy me either as a low-grade spook vehicle or an exercise in weird novel concept, because it both bores its audience and flanderizes its source material's cosmic horror to the point where it loses itself somewhere in the overwrought gibberish it ends up producing. But some people liked it. H. Bomber Guy did. He said,
"There's a part where Mark gets a dab of blood on his hand and wipes it on his trousers, and it's loving. You see the ribbing of the fabric, the seeping in of the blood, its shininess in the light. It knows to focus on the feel and atmosphere."
I find this an interesting detail to focus on because there is something satisfying about these frequent close-ups on things like the submarine controls or other little tactile elements, but I often felt while watching them that I was looking at B-roll. These shots are generic and they seem to go against that methodical slow-burn feel the movie angles for. They feel like a distraction. Look at this! We built a set. It feels a bit like watching an ad for the submarine. At Subs For You, it's buy one get one free on all rusted submarines. Constructed lovingly from industrial scrap metal that we found in an abandoned building with cockroaches scuttling all over it. Buy before the 12th of August and we'll throw in a free soiled bandage. Subs For You. Get wet with our crazy deals today. H-Bomb also sort of intellectualizes away the movie's agonizing boredom, interpreting this as a purposeful and deft application of the natural, relatable dullness that would inevitably come from being on a little death trap submarine for hours on your own.
The fear slowly becomes a crushing drudgery.
I love this beautiful vision of the purposeful employment of drudgery as a stylistic tool to remind the audience of the glum, drab, stinky reality of the miserable little submarine world, but I just don't feel that the boring parts of Iron Lung reflect this deeper misery at all. I think Markiplier wants to create space for brooding and waiting and, yes, focusing on the isolation, the emptiness, the sheer desolate nature of this environment, but I don't think the movie is boring for this reason, but really because he hasn't managed to create the atmosphere that would make these still scenes feel poignant, thick with anticipation. A lot of horror movies use these moments of downtime to provide a respite from the onslaught of the danger or a slow, steady descent into it. But here, we're just brought to a standstill watching Markiplier grunt. It's not even exciting when he starts wriggling around underneath the floor panels in a tense moment. It feels like another dull break from the sorely needed momentum, but it's ceaselessly dull when the movie just sits with him motionless. This is the movie's biggest flaw, and perhaps, I could imagine a valuable use of, if not boredom necessarily, some slow and considered time to just see our convict's little motions within his doomed tiny prison. But this is exactly what the film tries to do, to imbue still stretches of mark time with weight, with anticipation, with gloom. And it doesn't really work. It can't, because that man is just spitting out another F-word.
Fuck me.
Comments like this, the boredom was intentional, are always funny to me because, while it could be true that there's an intentional thematic through line to a movie's drudgery, people never feel the need to explain why a movie was intentionally interesting. Connor Ashdown Ford said that the movie does not arrive from the sanitized, predictable assembly lines of Hollywood. Instead, it emerges from the fiercely independent, self-funded trenches of modern DIY creator culture. Okay, I mean, Markiplier made it, so that's a true fact. But this doesn't track for me because in all of its visual and narrative choices, Iron Lung seems very invested in the typical conventions and stylistic choices of its Hollywood counterparts. It feels less like a small, contained project attempting to put forth an esoteric and thoughtful world of oddity, and more like a project fruitlessly chasing a normative, bombastic, rough-and-tough model of big-budget, horror-infused sci-fi, even with its little moments of stillness. It's like the confused, ramshackle disaster that was The Cloverfield Paradox if it was shot in a big cardboard box. It's like Underwater, the film about Kristen Stewart being underwater, if it had less style and less movement. It's like Annihilation if it was duller and darker and goofier. Markiplier may well be in the trenches of DIY creator culture, but the problem there is that he's still trying his utmost to make a really clean, big, chunky movie, and seems more focused on that image than on delivering a really strong, satisfying screenplay or the quality of performance an intimate one-room story requires.
That wasn't part of the plan. They didn't listen to me.
I'm really sorry.
I don't doubt that he wanted to transplant the game's lingering, eternal atmosphere into the ether of the movie, because that's what he loves about the game.
It's constant and pervasive, and any game that can create a constant and pervasive sense of death lurking right outside a thin metal wall is a pretty cool game in my book.
But translating that subtle, ever-present sense of quiet, jittery fear into a medium that can't make use of the effect of your own direct control over it is really challenging. And so instead, we end up with a world record for the largest amount of fake blood used in a movie. Okay, damn, that's crazy. You guys got the blood. A lot of people have brought up in their assessment of Iron Lung its status as an independent or DIY or YouTuber movie. People are excited and intrigued to see people who started out on YouTube step into a bigger, shinier world to really do it. One of Slate's first questions in their interview with Mark is this.
YouTuber, albeit a very successful one, to like, now are you filmmaker, auteur? Are you something different?
Interestingly, he rejects this framing. To him, the princely auteur and the lowly YouTuber are effectively versions of each other.
Making a movie is a very high level of skill that has way more roles than you could ever do. For me, it was always just like, well, I did that anyway when I was making YouTube videos. It's no different, it's just on a different skill level.
And that's interesting, right? There's this looming sense that the capital I industry and the culture at large view these two things as entirely separate. And there's a broad understanding that YouTube is an amateur free-for-all and that professionally produced and distributed movies are, conversely, meticulously crafted feats of talent, works of high culture. And there's some truth to slicing it this way. Movies have an attached establishment and occupy a particular kind of format and structure, where YouTube videos can be posted by anyone and are loose, undefined, and almost limitless. But of course, there's crossover. Is it shocking that a YouTuber could make a movie? Is it shocking that Justin Bieber became a megastar when he too was once merely posting videos? Joel Haver, a YouTube-based filmmaker, made a really interesting video about this topic recently. It's a very sweet and funny video. He pokes fun at the sort of baffled incredulity of it all.
YouTubers are making movies. I could have told you this 20 years ago.
He talks about how this isn't necessarily distinct from many a famous director's start in filmmaking.
I really fail to see how it's that different from filmmakers who got their start making movies with Roger Corman or Lloyd Kaufman in Troma like James Gunn or making music videos. All these people made movies on their own with the cheapest tools available to them and then through whatever means necessary were able to get the attention of the industry to create further projects and budgeted projects.
And he talks about how YouTubers like Ryan Higer fueled his own passion for filmmaking.
I also remember my brother, my friend John, and I remade Ryan Higa's how to be ninja.
He points out so beautifully the unseverable connection between whatever we might consider prestigious, grand media and low entertainment filth.
It just goes to show, when kids have the tools in front of them to create the things they like to watch, they are going to give it a big swing. There's nothing more powerful in this world than feeling like you can.
It's not that so-called low media is necessarily equivalent to the Scorsese box set or whatever. It's not that all entertainment gives us something and so there must be an equivalency, but rather that there are often profound or unique or emotional or thoughtful or funny-ass moments in either. Sometimes amateur work can be better than establishment work. I mean, this isn't news. While Disney makes another dour live-action remake of one of its classics, strange film festivals are accepting weird movies made by tall and aloof women. Some of the greatest films I've ever seen have been super amateur in nature. Creep, The Dirties, Chickens in the Shadows.
What do you think?
Was there airbrushing with this picture, or did I always look like that?
That's you, baby.
This is why I find it hard to take claims of the sheer slay of Iron Lung as a DIY passion project that seriously, because I've seen The Dirties, and its last scene had my jaw on the floor.
I don't think we can have a film where you're shooting your teacher.
You're gonna gut it! You're talking about gutting the movie!
I'm not gutting it.
This is a movie that absolutely requires its DIY approach and uses it as a tool for framing an elaborate meta-narrative that both comments on and propels the weird, complex emotional heart of the story. Seriously, watch The Dirties. You will laugh, you will cry, you'll throw up. Obsession is an interesting movie, and it's really at the center of this current wave of attention, which is interesting because this is not only a movie that is utterly professional, but if you look at director Curry Barker's YouTube stuff, it has the exact same feel.
Damn, that looks attractive on you.
Oh, thanks, man.
No homo.
What?
These are mostly comedic skits, but watching them, you see obsession. Barker has a very clear, recognizable voice. There's no sense of the amateur about these because they are so tightly written and well performed. They're cut to perfection. He simply doesn't feel like a YouTuber, and so I think in his case, it becomes super appealing to apply the YouTuber label, like we're going to the YouTuber zoo to look at the YouTuber enclosures, because there is no identifiable sign of any YouTuber sensibility here at all.
No!
This is a filmmaker with a YouTube channel, and that is so distinct from Markiplier, who is not just a YouTuber, but of course, a celebrity YouTuber. It's hard to imagine Markiplier's Iron Lung as anything but a movie built on Markiplier's particular established thing. It feels amateur, sure, but it is, in its own odd way, an extension of the horror Let's Play shtick he's known for. It's certainly a property chosen for its precise appeal as one of those games. And in Markiplier's hands, it is at once too professional, too slick and shiny, and too amateur, too sloppy. But it does, in a way, feel like watching a Let's Play.
Did you just stuck down there too?
Markiplier credits himself as both Markiplier and Mark Fishbach in this movie. Perhaps that choice alone is emblematic of its indecisive nature. He had the spirit, and he sure had the blood, but he didn't have the sauce. Maybe next time, though. Maybe for his movie adaptation of Nesta's Funky Bowling.